This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Home prices around the country have taken a double dip. Prices had been rising a bit last year with the help of a federal tax credit, but with that stimulus gone, prices are now sliding again, down more than 30% from the peak. Still, some people think renting is smarter than buying, but more economists are saying it is now a very good time to buy. NPR's Chris Arnold reports on Americans' changing attitudes toward home ownership.
Since the housing bubble burst, there's been some questioning of home ownership. A Time magazine cover story declared that owning a home may no longer make economic sense. Politicians are under fire for over-promoting home ownership.
So are the good old days of building your wealth via home ownership dead and gone?
There's been plenty of talk on CNBC and other TV networks about all this.
Are Americans making a big mistake viewing their homes as an investment opportunity, a way to build wealth? That's the key issue posed in today's front page New York Times story.
It's enough to make anyone thinking about buying a house hide under their bed in their rented apartment. But many economists say these concerns may be overblown.
Everyone's reevaluating more carefully whether they should own a home or not. But for the vast majority of Americans, home ownership is still the right thing.
Mark Zandi is the chief economist of Moody's Analytics. He says if you can afford it, there are a lot of advantages to home ownership. With a fixed interest rate, your home payment never goes up when you rent, and most places surely will. And even if home prices don't rise that much anytime soon, if you pay down the mortgage every month and you don't take out a huge home equity loan, there's an automatic savings for the future built into owning a house.
This is why home ownership has been such an important part of the American dream, because people have used it as a way to save, and it's been a relatively safe way to save. Now, of course, as we know, as we have seen, there are ups and downs. But in general, it's been a pretty good investment.
Okay, so ultimately, just because we had a housing crash doesn't change the nature of home ownership.
Well, the other thing to consider is that, like any asset, after a crash, after prices have fallen very quickly, everyone's very nervous, reticent to actually dive back in. But it's the people who do that benefit in the long run.
Zandi's been tracking home prices as they've fallen in cities and neighborhoods across the country, and he's been asking the question, does it make sense for people to buy a home right now?
Yeah, I think the arithmetic is such that if you plan to live in your home 5 or more years, then you should really consider buying a single-family home in most parts of the country. Prices have fallen so far. It's very affordable, man. It's now even attractive relative to renting.
Well, it's been getting cheaper to own a home. In many places, it's actually been getting more expensive to rent a place to live. Gleb Nechayev is a housing economist in Boston with CBRE Econometric Advisors. It's a real estate research firm. And when we stopped by, he was printing out his latest research.
So we're picking up our graphs here.
Is the chart you've printed out?
Yes, it is.
Nechayev's chart shows the cost of owning a house, the principal and interest payment, compared to renting. We also spoke with him back in 2006 when this cost of owning line on the chart was reaching its peak, and now the line has plunged down and down.
We're at the very bottom of that mountain right now, and we've never seen that ratio so low.
Nechayev's data goes back to 1986, and he says since then, it's never been this cheap to own a house as compared with the cost of renting. Of course, these are national averages, and there are some big differences depending on the city and the neighborhood and the type of home, if it's in good shape or bad shape. We have charts breaking some of that down at NPR.org. But overall, it's gotten so cheap in many areas that Nechayev is puzzled by why more people aren't buying.
The fact that we haven't seen people jumping at this opportunity does suggest that we might be witnessing some kind of changing perception of homeownership.
Nechayev says a part of it might be that younger people are deciding against the suburbs and choosing to live in cities where it can still be harder to find and afford a nice home or condo in a good neighborhood. Also, he says with the economy still shaky, job mobility is a big issue for many people. In other words, if they have to move to take a new job, that's a lot easier to do if they're renting. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
And now to a political standoff that shows why it's so difficult to get municipal pension costs under control. A controversial perk allows city employees in Philadelphia to cash in on their pensions before they retire. The provision is up for debate today. Philadelphia's Democratic mayor is pushing to end it, but as NPR's Joel Rose reports, he's meeting fierce resistance from the city council and municipal unions.
It's not unusual for city workers in Philadelphia to retire for a day, take a 5- or 6-figure pension payment, and then go right back to work at their old jobs. This is perfectly legal under a city program known as DROP, short for Deferred Retirement Option Plan. Zach Stahlberg at the Election Watchdog Committee of 70 says there are a lot of people who want to see DROP dropped.
They hate the idea of especially elected officials walking away with a package of several $100,000, retiring for one day and then coming back to work in a day when most people don't even get pensions anymore.
This is not exactly how DROP was intended. It was created in the 1990s when Philadelphia was having trouble retaining experienced cops and firefighters. The idea is that city workers would announce their retirement plans a few years ahead of time. In return, they get a big chunk of money from their own pension funds in a lump sum. Thousands of city employees rushed to sign up for this unusually generous perk, right up to the president of the city council and a former mayor. So last year, current mayor Michael Nutter ordered a study to find out how much DROP really costs.
And the answer is clear and direct. The program has cost us money, a lot of it. We can't afford it anymore, and we need to get rid of the program.
The administration study found that DROP cost the city $258 million over 10 years, but DROP does have its defenders.
All you ever see are the big dollars.
Kathy Scott is president of AFSCME District Council 47, a union that represents city workers. She says the mayor and the media have given DROP a bad name by focusing only on the big payouts.
They focus on the highly compensated people, the elected officials who are getting very large DROP amounts. They never talk about what the average person gets.
Scott says the average lump sum payment is only about $100,000, and her argument has found some traction in Philadelphia City Council, where members seem wary of alienating city workers and their unions. Lawmakers commissioned their own study of DROP, which found that the program has cost the city only $110 million. Councilwoman Janie Blackwell speaks for many on council who say the program should be reformed rather than scrapped.
I really think John and Jane Q. Public deserve the program. Rank and file citizens who retire from the city, who haven't made a lot of money all the years they've been working, and who could use a little nest egg of their own money that they saved over the years to help them as they transition to retired life. So I think that we need to keep it for them, if for no one else.
Philadelphia is one of dozens of cities and states that face a looming pension crisis. Recent studies by researchers at Northwestern and the University of Rochester put unfunded municipal pension liabilities at well over $3 trillion. They say Philadelphia's pension alone is underfunded by more than $9 billion. Compared to numbers like that, Zach Stahlberg at the Committee of 70 says DROP is just a drop in the bucket.
But it's become the symbol of the city's pension problem, its pension mess. So literally, it can't afford it. But beyond that, it comes down to do you have the will to try to fix the pension problem or not?
So far, critics of DROP say the answer seems to be no. Joel Rose, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, it's LGBT Pride Month, that designation made by the White House for the third year in a row. We've been observing the month with conversations that explore issues of particular interest to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community. Today, we're going to talk about a new report on the health challenges of the LGBT community and new information about how we know just how many LGBT people there really are. That conversation in a few minutes. But first, another conversation about the economy. So much of the conversation in Washington these days is about cutting government spending, not if, but how much. But a new group says the solution to the budget deficit is to raise taxes. And no, we're not talking about so-called tax and spend liberals. This comes from a group of very wealthy Americans. 200 of them, who call themselves the Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength, have signed a letter to President Obama and Congress asking them to raise their taxes and the taxes of the 375,000 other Americans who earn more than $1 million a year. Let's listen to a clip from a video the Patriotic Millionaires released yesterday.
We shouldn't be wallowing in our riches while everybody else is suffering.
10 years ago, you gave me a tax cut I didn't want and I didn't need.
Fix the mistake you made.
Because it is the right thing to do.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me.
Tax me because my country, our country, means more than my money.
We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called on entrepreneur Dennis Meehl. He is chairman of U.S. Corrugated. They make cardboard boxes, and they operate plants in 15 states, among other businesses that he runs and owns. And he's with us now from NPR New York. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Michelle, it's nice to be here.
We also wanted the perspective of a small business owner, so we've called upon Andy Shalal. Now, we've called upon him from time to time for comment about the economy and how things are going. He owns the restaurants Busboys and Poets and Eatonville in the Washington, D.C. area, and he's with us once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
So, Dennis Meehl, I'm going to start with you. As you know probably better than anybody, kind of the narrative around the economy these days is cutting spending, not raising taxes, and Republicans have said that that's a core issue for them in these negotiations, that they are not in favor of raising taxes at all. Why do you feel that it's important to raise taxes right now and on you?
Well, because you got to go where the money is. the reason we need to increase the marginal tax rate, in my view, on high earners is because it's absolutely essential that it's part of bringing some balance to our fiscal policies in this country. And if people say that the only approach is to reduce expenditures as we look out into the future, then what they're really saying is that the sacrifices that need to be made to move toward more balance in our fiscal policies, that those sacrifices have to be made by the people who essentially have the least.
Well, part of the timing around this effort by you and your other wealthy individuals is that 10 years ago, President Bush signed a law that heavily cut taxes. And the argument is that cutting taxes actually enhances economic growth by creating more jobs, giving people more money to spend and invest. And so I wanted to ask, did you personally benefit from the Bush tax cuts, and what did you do with the money?
Well, the answer to the first half of the question, I did benefit. My marginal tax rate is lower. It saves me whatever, $200,000 to $300,000 a year that I might otherwise have paid. It's a spurious argument that maintaining historically low marginal rates on very high earners, that somehow if they had to pay an extra 3 or 4%, which would be from $30,000 a year up to some multiple of that, depending on how much they own, that we're going to have less jobs. It's wrong, and history disproves it.
Andy Shalal, what's your perspective on this? And one of the reasons that I wanted to get your perspective on this is that the argument is that small businesses are particularly affected by the growth in government spending because it reduces the amount of capital available to them. So tell me, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that most of the small businesses that we're talking about would not be affected by this proposed sort of pullback in the Bush-era tax cut. But the other part is that for me, as a subchapter S business, I have an incentive to spend more money before the end of the year, so I don't claim it as income. So for me, I spend it on infrastructure, I spend it on equipment, I spend it on refurbishing the places and so on. So that is an incentive. I could never understand the other argument of, you're going to have more money, it's going to be taxed. Well, spend it.
I would ask Andy a question.
Sure.
Okay. Because what's put forward by the other side in this debate is that a so-called small business person, whatever that means, if you were going to earn $1 million for the year, for example, then on the arithmetic, you might experience $20,000 or $30,000 more in taxes through your subchapter S than otherwise might have been the case if you made $1 million. Now, the argument is because you paid $20,000 or $25,000 more in taxes and you had an opportunity to open a restaurant around the corner that was going to be successful, that having made $25,000 less than $1 million, that you would not open that restaurant. I mean, I think it's preposterous on its face.
Well, I would agree with you.
Yeah, so it really doesn't hold water. And what it suggests is that regardless of the talking points and staying on message and all that, that the motives are different.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking to Dennis Meehl. He is one of the 200 millionaires who have signed a letter asking the government to raise their taxes. We're also talking with Andy Shalal. He's owner of Busboys and Poets here in Washington, D.C. We called him for a small business owner's perspective.
Mr. Mayor, one of the things I was curious about is that when the prospect of raising taxes is offered up, sometimes there are two issues here. One is the economic theory at work. That's what House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan says, that his issue is it's not politics, it's economic theory. He really believes that keeping taxes as low as possible is the thing that stimulates growth in the economy. But the other argument is political, and that the argument is that this is class warfare, that when you talk about raising taxes, really what you're pitting, you know, the wealthy and successful against the less successful. So I'm curious, though, why you think your argument doesn't seem to have greater resonance to this point, particularly given that the number of people who are making this kind of money are a minority in the population. So why do you think that is?
Well, to begin with, I think we can rationally conclude that those people who are making the most money, and we've got people making up to a billion, I mean, I'm a piker next to a lot of the guys on that letter, okay, have the resources and the access to policymakers, to elected officials, and so on, that enable them to amplify their point of view in a way that the average person can't. When people talk about class warfare, I struggle with that a little bit. I think we have increasing income diversity in the country. Disparity, I think, is the word I was looking for. And as that grows, and it has grown substantially over the last 30 or 40 years, it puts the whole social contract under pressure and can lead to conditions and attitudes that we would not recognize as part of the value system that we have in this country. But we're not trying to create class warfare by pitting one group against another. We're saying that everybody needs to contribute to putting our fiscal house back in order. And I'll just say, not to be overly partisan, mm-hmm. but the Republicans and Mr. Ryan say that it's absolutely wrong to ask anybody, irrespective of how great their resources are, to chip in what everyone agrees is a very, very significant challenge for our country. Makes no sense to me. So I think they are pitting the classes against each other by framing the debate on that basis. I reject that argument.
Andy?
And the statistics have sort of borne out. I mean, since 1979, the income disparity has gotten much, much wider. The top 1% of earners since 1979 have seen an increase of 280% in their income. The lower 2% of earners have seen an increase of 16%. The disparity is becoming wider and wider. I want to see more customers out there with money to come spend in my business. I don't want to see that as we're talking about the possibility of having the haves and have-nots and having this big disparity in our classes here in this country.
Andy, before we let you go, I wanted to ask just final thought. As we are talking, they're still sort of talking about a plan to reduce the budget deficit. From your perspective as a small business owner, what would you like these people to keep in mind, these lawmakers to keep in mind as they're having these discussions? What do you think is the key fact for you?
You know, we tend to think in this country that the idea of leveling the playing field is the way that you have fairness. But the reality is that people with money have a head start, and therefore leveling the playing field is only going to set people that don't have money further back and create a bigger, wider schism between the two. So we have to have more progressive tax laws in place in order for us to be able to bridge that gap so that we don't have this potential, really, for this possible class warfare that's always bubbling underneath the surface in this country.
Mr. Meehl, final thought from you?
Just that I'm hoping and I'm praying that our policymakers and our elected officials find a way to do the right thing. The current proposal that our group has made is really doesn't go anywhere close to as far as it needs to go. It would be a step in the right direction. And out of that, hopefully, will come. We'll put to rest this idea that they're going to hold our country's credit rating and financial stability hostage to what appears to be an ideological agenda. Hopefully cooler heads will prevail and we can start to make some consensual progress in this country.
Dennis Meehl is the chair of U.S. Corrugated. He's also a member of a group called the Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength. They've just signed a letter to President Obama and the Congress asking them to raise their taxes and the taxes of the hundreds of thousands of other Americans who earn more than $1 million a year. He was with us from NPR New York. Andy Shalal was also with us. He's the owner of the Busboys and Poets Restaurant Group and Eatonville here in the Washington, D.C. area. And he was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Car sales in the U.S. have stalled. Right now, GM sells more cars in China than it does in America. Around the world, the American brands have a much higher cool factor. For example, GM's Buick is a hip car in China, and the U.S. car companies are looking to exploit that, as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
Let's talk about the future of the American car companies. I can sum that future up in a word: BRIC. Okay, actually, BRIC is an acronym.
The B for the Brazil, R for Russia, I for India, C for China. Did I say it okay, or did you want me to say it again?
Nah, I think we got it. BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Oh, and that's Michelle Krebs. She's a senior analyst with Edmunds.com, the automotive website. She's going to help walk us through this. So what's so important about Brazil, Russia, India, and China?
They are the fastest growing markets in the world.
They also have established manufacturing, and they're making money on commodities. That means they have cash. And
there's a young population that is coming into driving age, and there's a growing middle class in all of those countries that is making it possible to buy cars that never existed before.
Well, that potential has not been lost on the American carmakers. This week, they laid out their plans for the future. GM did it at its annual shareholders meeting in Detroit. I should say its first shareholders meeting since GM came out of bankruptcy. Here's Dan Akerson, the CEO of General Motors.
It really is the new GM. And we have a new attitude.
I just need to point out that every single time Dan Akerson gets up in front of an audience, he talks about the new GM. To be sure, the old GM was a dominant force globally, and the new GM is no slouch either. In the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, GM is the leader.
In the BRIC countries, between now and 2015, that volume will grow by 12 million units. That bodes well for us in the future.
Michelle Krebs, the analyst, says it's important to remember that the biases that many Americans have against GM and Ford don't carry over to other countries. When GM was losing consumer confidence and market share in the U.S., it was planting its flag overseas with, of all brands, Buick.
People just shook their head and said, that is just preposterous. It's a very harebrained idea. What are they doing? Looking back on that now, it was a stroke of genius because General Motors got in there early. They established a foothold, and they have grown and grown.
And they want to grow more. GM will be launching a new brand, much less fancy than Buick, one that's really, really basic, that's aimed at those young consumers who are pouring into the cities in China, buying their first car. Meanwhile, Ford won't be outdone. It says it wants to sell about 3 million more cars outside the U.S.
Kan een auto door de grill te openen en te sluiten de aerodynamica verbeteren?
That's one of Ford's global commercials. It's part of Ford's plan to streamline itself and gain economies of scale all over the globe. Ford just announced yesterday that it's starting a new partnership in Russia, where the company will get a plant near St. Petersburg. Gary Bradshaw is a portfolio manager with Hodges Capital Management in Dallas. He says the American companies may have been knocked down a few notches in the U.S., but in the rest of the world?
Just remember that the whole world is growing at a 5% GDP growth. Whether they're in India or China or Brazil or Pakistan or wherever you want to say, they want to live like me and you.
Bradshaw says hopefully that means they want two cars in the garage. That, he says, is reason enough to bet on the U.S. car industry. Sonari Glinton, NPR News, Detroit.
More coming up from All Things Considered.